If you're like me, the first thing you do when traveling is check out what's happening with the local food scene, right? And as I've been planning my big book tour and live podcast tapings all around the country, man, I am very excited to eat my way across the nation. There's Atlanta, there's Miami, and so many more. Getting a taste of local food is the best way to get to know the local culture. And if you travel, you know that's how it's done. The Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card. If you travel, you know. Did you ever cook on the kibbutz?
No. I did many, many other jobs. I worked in the cornfield, watermelon field, in a kiosk. We had like in this country club that was open to outside, like to the city people. And that job I really loved because I was responsible to make paninis. It was just like a fun gig. Relatively to the other, you know, the other jobs were very difficult. I also worked at the communal, how you say it, like when, where you iron your clothes.
Like a dry cleaner. Not really. But
yeah,
like,
not really.
Right. Like a laundromat.
Yes. Okay. That was a nightmare. Truly.
So you like pressing paninis, you don't like pressing clothes.
Exactly. Okay. To this day. Yes.
This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. This week's episode is a conversation with Naama Shefi, founder of the Jewish Food Society. We taped it back in February, and it's about her personal journey, growing up in Israel, coming to the U.S., and using food to create Jewish community in America. But we can't talk about Israel without acknowledging all the suffering that's going on there, and especially in Gaza. I won't go into specifics here. I'm sure you're aware of it. A staggering number of people have been displaced, taken hostage, and killed. I know folks around the world, including me, we're all feeling the pain of all of it. If you want to support some of the organizations providing aid to people in need on the ground, we have links in our show notes. The Jewish holiday of Passover is a few weeks away, and like with a lot of holidays, it's a time of ritual and tradition. The Passover observance is called a Seder, which means order, because there's a specific order you're supposed to follow. In my family, the meal part of the Seder has always been things like matzo ball soup and beef brisket, foods with roots in Eastern Europe, because, like most American Jews, my family is Ashkenazi, meaning we trace our roots back to Eastern Europe. So our traditional foods also include things like smoked fish, potato knishes, and noodle kugel. But in recent years, I've become more curious about what Jews from other parts of the globe have spent generations cooking and eating. That's why I'm so excited about the release of a new cookbook called The Jewish Holiday Table, a world of recipes, traditions, and stories to celebrate all year long. It's a project from an organization called the Jewish Food Society and its founder, Naama Shefi. I invited Naama into the studio to talk about the book, but first I wanted to hear her backstory to understand why documenting Jewish food from around the world is so important to her. Naama grew up in Israel in the 80s and 90s, on a kibbutz there.
Kibbutz is a small community. A collective that traditionally it was based on agriculture. My kibbutz, Givat HaShlosha, which is a kibbutz in the center of Israel, there were 600 members when I grew up. So very tight bubble.
So you mean that like in a true sort of commune, socialist, communist type of vibe?
Yes.
Like everything is shared?
Yes. We weren't allowed to have any private ownership. So we were sharing everything. Toys, clothes, cars.
Yeah, there were like seven cars? Or how many? Like
there were 17 state-of-the-art Subaru.
Subarus. I love, of course it's Subarus.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, you really needed a good reason, like to get a car, and you know, to go to an event, to visit relatives, or to go to a wedding, God forbid, a funeral, or to see a doctor. You needed a good reason.
And how religious was the kibbutz?
Oh, it's the most secular place on earth.
A lot of Jews in Israel identify as secular, which means they consider themselves culturally Jewish. They take part in holiday celebrations, but they often skip the part at a synagogue. And that was the environment at the kibbutz. It was a place where, in some ways, there were a lot of rules, like who got to drive the communal cars. But it was also a place with a lot of freedom.
Listen, it was pretty idyllic to grow up in that environment. We were roaming the kibbutz barefoot, picking up fruits from the tree. There were a lot of pomegranates, a lot of oranges. We were playing outside for many, you know, long hours. Our parents didn't know where we were and what we were up to. But not everything was idyllic. We ate all of our meals in the communal dining room. So breakfast, lunch, and dinner together with 500 people.
And what was not idyllic specifically about the meals?
The community part was lovely, eating in community. But the menu, less so. It was just like pretty repetitive and bland. You know, think army food. Some days we had very sad spaghetti that sat in a sauce for too long. stuffed peppers, like really like nothing to write home about. Really like not exciting. The only part that I actually enjoyed and appreciated was the herring cart.
They wheeled a cart around?
They didn't wheel it. It was like in one of the corners of the Chadar Ochel.
Like the way that like a popcorn cart would be in the corner, except this one had, this one had pickled herring.
Exactly.
That's not what I expected. Usually herring, when you talk about certain traditional Jewish foods, that's not one that gets a lot of love.
I loved it. I think I appreciate it because the man who served the herring just put a lot of passion to his task, and he loved serving the herring. And I remember that he treated me really well because probably he saw like a little girl, like the only customer.
The only one who wanted more pickled fish.
Exactly. So it was just, you know, I think maybe I recognized a link to tradition because in the dining room, the stories were divorced from the recipes. And here, there was some sort of tradition and storytelling and a sense of nostalgia.
Things like spaghetti and meatballs, these were meals that were quick and accessible, but they had no cultural significance. Naama understood that the pickled herring was special because it was a link to Jewish food from the past. It was a piece of culture. And the herring cart wasn't the only good part of the food in the kibbutz. There was one other dish Naama remembers fondly.
There was one very talented cook named Batsheva, and her talent really sparked. Like, I remember one dish that she made for every Saturday lunch, chulent. This is like an overnight stew.
So kind of like Jewish chili.
Sure.
Yeah. It's a stew, meat, beans, you know, vegetables, right?
Yes.
Kind of whatever you have, you
potatoes
throw it in there.
Potatoes is a major, ingredient there. And she had a touch. Like, it was so good. So that's another highlight that I remember. And I would also say, I feel that I trashed, like, the dining room, which, yes, like that it's true.
But clear, Naama is not about to backtrack.
I do want to say that breakfast was pretty awesome because we were just talking like fresh vegetables,
right?
Eggs, cheese, like very basic situation, but super fresh.
As Naama got into her teens and traveled more to different parts of Israel with her family, she began to realize there was a lot more out there than the army meal she had in the kibbutz. And there were all kinds of people, just like the herring cart man, who loved to share their culture and heritage through food.
We went to the Yemenite quarter in Tel Aviv to try Yemenite soup. And we went to the neighboring Arab village of Kfar Qasim to eat hummus and roasted lamb. And it just like that was, you know, this mosaic of flavors that made me realize that food is culture. And for me, it was really a way to explore my identity outside of the kibbutz.
But this realization didn't immediately push Naama towards food as a career. Her first passion was film. She went to an arts high school in Tel Aviv where she studied filmmaking. She went to college there too and enrolled in a master's program in film. She moved to New York to finish her program. Like Israel, New York is also a hub of immigrants and immigrant food. But still, Naam had a bit of culture shock when it came to Jewish food here.
It was very clear when I moved to New York that when people here in the States, when they think about Jewish food, they think about Ashkenazi Jewish food. They think about, oftentimes, about deli food.
Ashkenazi food is sort of Eastern European Jewish food, which is most American Jews are Eastern European Ashkenazi Jews. So you get smoked salmon, bagels and cream cheese, potato knishes, whitefish salad, a couple other things.
Sure. And again, it's beautiful, but when I think about Jewish food, I think about Iraqi sabich or Yemeni jachnon or like just so many dishes from all around the world. So I just felt that it's unrepresentative in the way people think about, you know, Jewish food and people.
Naama struggled to find her place in the Jewish community in New York, where gatherings are often more centered around religious observances in synagogues. She wanted the community and culture without the religious part.
In retrospect, I took my Jewishness for granted. And here in New York, I just didn't find a way to realize my identity because I'm not interested in going to shul.
Temple,
or practice, you know, Judaism in that way. And that's where I started to dream of different experiences that I can create for myself and for my community through food.
Coming up, a fateful meal provides the inspiration Naama is looking for. Then later, we hear from a chef who contributed a recipe to Naama's cookbook for a very polarizing Jewish dish. Stick around.
Time to cook up some advertisements.
Whether you're a family vacation traveler, a business tripper, or a long weekend adventurer, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. They've got over 7,000 locations and 22 brands, including Comfort Hotels, Radisson Hotels, and Cambria Hotels, and you will get the best value for your money when you book with Choice Hotels. I especially love those Cambria Hotels. They have locally inspired hotel bars with all kinds of specialty cocktails, downtown locations right in the center of all the action. Radisson Hotels have flexible workspaces. That way, if you're a business traveler, you'll be able to get all your work done. On-site restaurants, fantastic. And then at Comfort Hotels, you'll enjoy free hot breakfast with fresh waffles and great pools for the whole family and spacious rooms. I mean, if you have kids, you understand the importance of the pool. If you stay at a hotel with a pool, almost nothing else matters. Fortunately, all the Choice Hotels take care of all the other stuff too. But I mean, a pool is a great start. Whatever kind of vacation you're going on, whatever kind of travel you're doing, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. This episode is brought to you by Merrick Pet Care. We have a dog. Her name is Sasha. She's almost four. She's a standard poodle. She's black and fluffy and soft and very adorable. And when we first got her, we took her to like this puppy kindergarten training class. The whole family went and, you know, they're teaching how to use the treats and all this. The trainer watched Sasha for a bit and said, she's very food motivated. And my daughter Emily turned to me and said, she's a Pashman. And so she is food motivated. And that's why we make a point of feeding Sasha high quality pet food. Founded in Hereford, Texas, Merrick has been crafting high-quality dog food for over 30 years. Real is Merrick's recipe, so they always use deboned meat, fish, or poultry as the number one ingredient. And let me tell you something. When it's dinner time, Sasha is motivated, okay? She is highly motivated to come in from patrolling the backyard at dinner, to get up off the couch, whatever she's doing, she will drop it and come running. Check out Merrick online or in your local pet store and look for their new packaging with real ingredients shown on the bag and inside it. I enjoy a nice glass of wine, but I don't pretend to be an expert in wine. I usually just want a wine that's high quality, delicious, and not too expensive. And to me, that's Bogle Family Vineyards. And here's the thing about Bogle. This is a third-generation family-owned winery from California that makes exceptional wines for about $10 a bottle. Bogle wines consistently earn Best Buy designations and high ratings from wine enthusiasts. And let me tell you something. The folks at Wine Enthusiast, they drink a lot of wine. They drink a lot of fancy, expensive wine. And yet they still keep giving great ratings to Bogle. And Bogle Vineyards has so many different kinds of wine. Whatever your mood, whatever you're eating, there's a wine for you. They got this great Pinot Grigio that's crisp and fruity, goes well with spicy foods, with fish. They have a classic Chardonnay that's balanced, amazing with a pork tenderloin or butter chicken. I like to take that Chardonnay and do what Jacques Pepin taught me, a couple of ice cubes in your glass of Bogle. If Jacques Pepin says it's okay, then it's okay. And there's the Bogle Pinot Noir, refined and elegant with bright fruit and about as food-friendly as a red wine can be. You're not going to believe it's only $10. Neither will your friends if you tell them. So pick up a few bottles of Bogle wherever you buy your favorite wines. Please drink responsibly. Are you ready for warmer weather? I know I am. But is your wardrobe ready? I just stocked up on spring and summer clothing at Quince. And let me tell you something. I'm feeling great about everything I got. I got a couple of short sleeve button down shirts, polo shirt, some shorts. Everything feels great. It's super high quality. And I can't believe how much stuff I got at a reasonable price. Quince has all the seasonal must-haves, like 100% European linen shirts from $30, performance polos, and versatile flow-knit activewear. The best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. Whatever you need for the spring and summer, Quince has your back. Upgrade your wardrobe. Go to quince.com/sporkful for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/sporkful to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/sporkful. I just got a very wonderful shipment of goodies from the folks at Reese's. And let me tell you something. These people remain the absolute worldwide leaders in bringing together chocolate and peanut butter. Of course, we know that peanut butter cups remain transcendent. But have you tried the Reese's Sticks? They're wafers with peanut butter in between each wafer, all coated in chocolate. I mean, the combination of sweet chocolate and salty peanut butter just brings people joy, and the folks at Reese's do it better than anyone. So shop Reese's Peanut Butter Cups now at a store near you, found wherever candy is sold. Welcome back to The Sporkful. I'm Dan Pashman. Thank you so much to all of you who've come out to see our tour, Sporkful Live, Anything's Possible. It has been a ton of fun doing these shows and getting to meet so many of you. And the tour continues this Saturday night in Philly. I'll be doing a live Sporkful taping in conversation with the Emmy-winning host of Check Please, Kehlani Palmisano. My book will be for sale. I'll hang out afterwards to sign copies of it. And this just in, we're teaming up with the Community College of Philadelphia's Culinary School. They're going to cook up something special with cascatelli and give out free samples. That's this Saturday night in Philly, and tickets are going fast. Speaking of tickets, our Boston and Seattle shows are already sold out. San Francisco and LA are close behind. The LA show will also include some food samples. Plus, I'll be in conversation with comedian Andy Richter. And get this, special appearance by my pasta fairy godmother, Evan Kleinman. Yes, Evan will be on stage with us. Get info and tickets for all our shows at sporkful.com/tour. Okay, back to my conversation with Naama Shefi. In 2005, Naama met Ilan, the man who would become her husband. He was living in Israel, she was in New York, and after a few years of dating, she traveled back to Israel to meet his family. One night, they went to visit Ilan's grandmother, who everyone called Nona, at her home outside Tel Aviv. Nona was preparing for a big family Shabbat dinner.
She lived in this one-bedroom apartment. I think it was like 500 square foot. Her dining table was just not that large. It was like kind of tiny. And I was like, how she is going to fit 20, 25 people around it? They all arrived and Nona made room for everyone. She started to cover the tables with pickles and lots of salads and albondigas and stuffed tomatoes and onions and a Swiss chard pie and just like so many dishes.
Like, did you say albondigas? Like,
albondigas.
I think that that's the Spanish word for meatballs.
Exactly.
So some people are going to be surprised to hear that that's on a table at a Jewish dinner.
And that's a direct evidence for the family roots in Spain.
Some of Nona's ancestors came from Spain and she grew up speaking Ladino, a Spanish Jewish language. She was born in Turkey. From there, her family moved to Greece, then Zimbabwe to escape the Nazis. And in 1976, they made it to Israel.
And every dish on that table represented this exact journey. And I was just like eating and eating and also need to make a good impression, you know. But I was just like, how did you make this? And what the story of this one?
Nona began telling the stories behind this array of dishes. There were recipes that came from long-held traditions and other ones that came from adapting to new cultures. There were also recipes that were more about survival, making meals from whatever you have on hand.
She had a dish of just like the peels of the zucchini with some paprika and lemon. And she talked about how you really needed to make, just to use 100% of everything. So, you know, I was just inspired by that. And I thought to myself, okay, we need to do something about it. We need to protect our legacy.
The next day, Naama and her husband Ilan returned to Nona's apartment and began documenting Nona's recipes. Since they were both working in film, they brought their video cameras and began recording Nona cooking her dishes. When Naama returned to New York, she started organizing events around Jewish food. She did one about Moroccan Jewish food. Then she did a whole conference about gefilte fish, a sort of fish meatball. It's popular around Passover, but also polarizing in American Jewish households because the gefilte fish you get in a jar at the store, it's filled with this gloopy jelly that's not very appetizing to a lot of folks. Naama sent her to a whole conference around it. Now just, I mean, like, to put this in terms of other cuisines, I imagine this would be kind of like creating a whole conference around Limburger cheese or lutefisk or durian. As these events grew, Naama realized food was a way for her to connect with the Jewish community without going to synagogue. In 2012, she hosted one event that stands out over all the others.
I feel that the event that was most satisfying for me or most powerful was the Kube Project. And it was an Iraqi Jewish comfort food concept. It gave me an opportunity to see firsthand the reaction of people that are coming in the door. And the first thing they said was like, what do you mean Iraqi Jewish? What do you mean? Jewish Arabs? Like, how can it be?
And what would you say if people, when people said that?
I would say, yes, there was a very extensive Jewish community in Iraq. And here we're here celebrating this community's food. I think that, you know, to this day, many people, when they think about Jewish people, they think about Eastern European representation. But 50% of the Jewish people who live in Israel today are from the Middle East and North Africa.
Naama is referring to Israeli Jews who are Sephardic or Mizrahi, who trace their origins to Spain, the Middle East, North Africa, and Central Asia. Through these food events, Naama was raising awareness about the diversity of the Jewish experience. And after a few years, this led her to a big moment. In 2017, she founded the Jewish Food Society.
Our mission is very simple. We work to preserve and celebrate and kind of push forward Jewish culinary heritage from all around the world. So at the heart of what we do is an online archive of family recipes and the histories that are attached to them. And to bring it to life, we host all sort of creative, crazy public program. So it could be seders, or it could be pop-ups, or educational panels, or different things.
I mean, I think there's merit to preserving all kinds of food history across all kinds of cuisines.
Sure.
Why do you feel like it was specifically important to preserve Jewish food history?
When I think about Jewish food, I think about a very global cuisine. For 2,000 years, Jewish people lived all around the world, and they created very unique and interesting micro cuisines that were a result of this very constant negotiation between Jewish traditions, including kashrut, the kosher dietary laws, and Shabbat and Jewish holidays, again, in negotiation with local food traditions and ingredients all around the globe.
For example, Jews in Rome eat a traditional ricotta cheesecake on Shavuot, which likely came from the Sephardic Jews who fled Sicily during the Spanish Inquisition. Jews who emigrated from Iraq to India have preserved a recipe for pantras, a fried crepe with chicken that's eaten on Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year.
It created very unique and fascinating kitchen.
I would think also part of it is that the Jews that were in those places aren't in a lot of those places anymore. They chose to leave or were forced out.
The later.
Right. I would think that also contributes to the desire to preserve.
100%. Yes. Like when I think about Jewish recipes, I think about the DNA of our culture. So I think that we can learn how people celebrated, loved, mourned, and endured.
After years of collecting and archiving these recipes, Naama and the Jewish Food Society have now published a cookbook, The Jewish Holiday Table. Each section of the book features one contributor's table for a certain Jewish holiday, everything they serve on that occasion, which varies widely from one person to another, depending on where their family has lived over the generations. Along with the recipes for all the dishes on each spread, there are stories of how these foods ended up on a Jewish person's table today.
There are a journey in the book of a family that immigrated from Baghdad to Calcutta in India. And then in the partition in 47, they moved to London. And now we are capturing a snapshot of their menu.
A lot of the sort of the family histories in this book read as sort of the history of the Jewish people being chased all around the globe.
Yes, yes. There is a family who moved in the 18th century from Morocco to northern Brazil. And Esther, the cook, shares with us her very unique Shabbat spread. Like, it's a whole menu and it's so interesting. And this is also what contributes to the deliciousness of the recipes. They are layered with flavors and traditions from different influences.
There's a celebration at the end of Passover that's unique to Moroccan Jews. It's called Mimouna. Another contributor to the book, Ruth Stellman, shares her recipes for that occasion. At its peak in the 1940s, the Jewish community in Morocco numbered 270,000. Ruth talks in the book about celebrating Mimouna while living in the Moroccan city of Rabat.
When she grew up, Mimouna was just a very joyous day where Jewish people and Muslims participated in this holiday. And she told us how she was like hoping from one place to another, and it was a custom to eat something sweet in every stop that you make. So it just sounded so incredible and so happy. The star of the table is a dish called moufleta, which is these crepes that is served with butter and honey.
In 1948, there were anti-Jewish riots in Morocco, killing 44 people. This triggered the first of several waves of emigration. And over the decades that followed, Moroccan Jews continued to leave the country. Today, there are only about 2,000 Jews left in Morocco. Ruth's family left in 1971 and moved to Virginia, outside of Washington, D.C.
They settled in a community that there weren't other Moroccan Jews. Her mom, Perla, decided to, you know, literally wear their Jewish tradition and celebrated Mimouna every year with a bang, with all the traditional customs, you know, the jalabiyas and like with the music and with the spread and with the open door policy, and invited neighbors and everyone to participate.
Including a lot of non-Jewish people.
Yes. And again, for me, I appreciate how back then, and still, by the way, they host Mimouna every year, how they wear their tradition with a lot of pride.
Another contributor is Fanny Gerson, who owns the donut shop Fan Fan Donuts in Brooklyn. One of my faves, by the way. Her guava and cheese glazed braided donut is in my pastry hall of fame. Anyway, Her family fled Ukraine and moved to Mexico City, where Fanny grew up. For the cookbook, Fanny shares her table for a Passover Seder, including her take on a family recipe for the infamous gefilte fish.
She shared with us a version for a Mexican gefilte fish, which is just so tasty. You know, it has chilies, you know, peppers, it's in a red sauce, and it's very tangy and spicy. And the fish cakes, it's seared. It's just like a very lavish, beautiful dish.
I gotta say, if it's half as good as Fanny's donuts, count me in. Fanny also contributed recipes for Passover brisket tamales and a Mexican chocolate-covered caramelized matzah. Here's Fanny reading an excerpt from her section of the cookbook. Her essay is entitled, A Mexico Meets New York Kind of Seder.
The first real Seder I hosted was a year after I graduated from culinary school. I was about 20 and living in a tiny New York apartment far from my family in Mexico City. When I realized I didn't have anywhere to go for Seder, I decided that I was going to make my home the place that people, whether Jewish or not, could come to. I was keeping the tradition I grew up with, but making it my own. I was homesick and wanted to make the dishes that we ate at my grandmother Anna's house. My great-grandmother, Babi Lena, who immigrated from Ukraine to Mexico in 1926, was the one who cooked these dishes originally. She served her matzo ball soup with lime and made a red gefilte fish served in a warm tomato sauce that was spicy from lots of white pepper. Every time I've cooked for the holiday since, I've felt her presence. One of the years when I made matzo ball soup with bone marrow, I felt like she was there saying, "That's how we used to do it." I'm not sure she ever made it that way, but I imagine her hands guiding me. Much as she created dishes bridging her two worlds, I created my own, which are rooted in nostalgia for Mexico and for a relationship with her that has lived on in my imagination.
The foods that Fanny grew up with and adapted are a perfect example of the breadth of Jewish food culture that's still little known in America. I'm still learning about it myself, just as Naama has been for so long, ever since she started venturing off the kibbutz all those years ago. I asked her how growing up in that environment continues to influence her today.
I know that there are traits or that there are habits or that there are things that stuck with me, like this yearning for community or like to organize like stuff all the time or to trust people.
It's interesting to think that like your time on the kibbutz, that very communal upbringing would lead you later in life to create an organization that is very communal.
Totally. This is news to me, but it's right. I didn't think about it this way.
Oh, interesting.
It's a therapy session. Fun.
I'll send you a bill later. Yeah. When you decided to come out to work on this cookbook and set the publication date, you didn't know what else would be going on in the world at the time that it came out. How has the last few months affected how you think about your work?
Where to begin? It's hard to summarize how it's been affected, and because I'm still digesting it, probably every hour of every day, to be honest with you. But I look at this book differently, you know. I feel that there is a tragic and very painful war that is going on in Israel and Gaza. And on top of that, there is another war that is going on social media, here in New York, in other parts of the world, where I feel that some people just misunderstanding the Jewish story. So, and I'm talking about the rise of anti-Semitism, specifically about the heavy Jewish hate that we feel, and of course I feel it, and my team and like everyone around me feel it. But at the same time, I then turn to the pages of the book and I just take strength and joy and hope from their stories. So, yes, these are extremely dark time, but I'm trying to stay hopeful. And there is also the power of community. What I learned from the research is that for many, many cooks that share their stories, you know, when you think about holidays, it was really a time where the entire community came together to cook and just be with one another. And I just find it to be so powerful. Like the hardest the times, the stronger the bonds.
That was Naama Sheffi. She's the founder of the Jewish Food Society. You can get her book, The Jewish Holiday Table, wherever books are sold. We're also doing a giveaway right now. To enter to win a copy of The Jewish Holiday Table, all you have to do is sign up for the Sporkful newsletter by April 21st. If you're already on the list, you're already entered into this and all of our giveaways. Open to U.S. and Canada addresses only. Sign up today at sporkful.com/newsletter. Before we sign off, got some exciting news. We have been nominated for a Webby Award. Yes, this is a big deal. Webby Award. Anyone can vote in the Webby, so if you have a minute, please vote for us. Go to sporkful.com/webby to vote today. Voting closes April 18th. Thanks. Next week on the show, I talk with my friend Elise Whitney, who just published the cookbook Big Dip Energy, 88 parties in a bowl for snacking, dinner, dessert, and beyond. Elise's energy for dips knows no bounds. And as you'll hear, her love for dips is only matched by her love of dip-related puns. It's going to be fun. Meanwhile, if you're looking for more Sporkful episodes, be sure you check out last week's show about growing up as a picky eater and why picky eating is still something that's judged harshly by society. And if you want to attend a live Sporkful taping and book signing, I'm on tour right now. Tickets are still available for my shows in Philly, San Francisco, and LA. For all the info, go to sporkful.com/tour. This episode was produced by me, along with managing producer
Emma Morgenstern
and senior producer
Andres O'Hara.
It was edited by
Nora Ritchie.
Our engineer is
Jared O'Connell.
Music help from Black Label Music. The Sporkful is a production of Stitcher Studios. Our executive producers are Nora Ritchie and Colin Anderson. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
This is Rudy from Austin, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity, set up chores, and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.